Yesterday's, as recorded on the new Dave Brubeck Quartet record called Back Home on the Concord Jazz label, we heard Brubeck at the piano. Jerry Baganzi was the tenor player. Brubeck's son Chris Brubeck was featured on bass and Butch Miles on drums. Well, I'm pleased to say my special guest on Fresh Air is Dave Brubeck. I'm sure you're familiar with his music, but let me just refresh your memory a little bit about his career. He formed his now legendary quartet in the early 1950s with alto saxophonist Paul Desmond. In 1954, he made it onto the cover of Time magazine, and in 1960, his quartet's album Time Out became the first jazz album to sell over 1 million copies. In addition to his jazz playing and composition, Dave Brubeck has composed cantatas, oratorios, ballets, and works for solo piano, chamber groups, and symphony orchestras. He's in Philadelphia today for the premiere of his Mass to Hope, a Mass for a New Decade. The performance will be held at the Cathedral Basilica at 8 o'clock tomorrow on 18th and the Parkway in Philadelphia. If you'd like any information about attending this premiere, you can call 587-3696. You may be wondering what Dave Brubeck's been up to recently. In 1977, he was named a Duke Ellington Fellow by Yale University. In the late 70s, he played and toured and recorded with his musician sons, and his new Dave Brubeck Quartet features his son, Chris Brubeck, and they'll have another album coming out on Concord probably in August. Dave Brubeck, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Before we talk a little bit about your music in general, let's talk specifically about this Mass that premieres in Philadelphia tomorrow night. What was the inspiration for it? How did the Mass come to be?
Well, I was asked to write it, and of course, I, not being a Catholic, I didn't think I could handle the Mass because they wanted... I think the term would be an ordinary Mass for Sunday services. And the Mass I have written will be able to be used on Sunday services if you don't do the whole thing. Just say the first part of each piece. There's a break that I've built into the pieces. And a Catholic sister, Sister Theophane Heitrich, is shortening it also, and she's pretty much doing it where I would have, making the cuts. But the Mass you'll hear tomorrow night, I think, could be done in an auditorium away from a cathedral or a church. And they've decided in that situation they may call it a festival Mass, and then you do it in its entirety. Now, tomorrow night, three sections will not be performed because I wrote way too much. I was afraid I would write way too much because it's hard for me to just think in terms of short segments, which you do have in the Mass. And there's whole sections that even in the festival Mass I would like to develop further someday. And it's very hard for me to say why I did it. But I have had written a little over a year ago, a piece for the Lutheran Church, which is an Easter cantata. And before that, my wife and I had written a Mexican Christmas cantata, which is recorded on Columbia Records, but not released in this country, unfortunately. Very good recording with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra with Dennis Russell Davies conducting, and a wonderful cast of people. And it's every December I do this Mass across the country. I mean this Mexican cantata. So I've done a series of pieces, one for the UAHC using Martin Luther King and as part of the text, and the Old Testament. And it goes on and on back till the first piece. So this is my sixth one, the Mass.
You're Jewish, right?
No.
Oh.
No. And that's very strange. Everyone wonders what I am, and I don't know. And I can spot maybe four things that are in my background pretty accurately. Maybe Polish or Russian. Like, I don't know which part there. And maybe some German. And for sure some English and Scottish. And then there's some other things that I can't prove that one way or another. But all my life, people have been very confused about what nationality I am. And since the Mass last night, one of the choir members knew I must be Italian.
Do you practice any religion?
Not, the Christian. I don't belong to any church, and I'm very much, I have to be very careful, because I like so much of so many religions that I think I think they're all so related. But if you had me to pin me down to one thing, I'd say I'm a Christian.
Do you want your spiritual music, like your Mass that will be premiered tomorrow night, to evoke any spiritual thoughts in the people who are listening? You know, are there things that you hope your music inspires in its listeners?
Oh, yeah, sure. And the different sections of the Mass, the Kyrie, I hope that that inspires people like a Kyrie should, or the Peace of Jerusalem. That was each piece I had to approach with the idea that I hoped it reached a Catholic audience, and I tried to put myself in the framework of, will it work in a Catholic church? And I've never had to actually work that hard to hope it would work in a certain environment. When I wrote the piece for the Lutheran church, the text was done by a Lutheran minister who is very avant-garde, and he pushes at the outer fringe of what is accepted in that church. So anytime I was pushing too hard in a certain direction, I could always blame it on one of their own ministers. He's a poet. And when I did the piece for the UAHC, I had two rabbis, and were always saying whether I was going in the right direction. And we would have meetings, my wife and I, with them to see. So you have to be very careful not to do something that's, you can immediately overstep in a religious situation where, if you just go outside where it's accepted, you're going to lose all your work. And I'm not about to work a year on something and then be stupid and do something that is going to upset people.
So what would upset people? Is it a note or a chord or a structure?
No, it's usually in the text.
Ah.
Or do something where it's just not in the tradition to treat that text that way. And not being from these traditions, you don't know all that. So you do want to have some people where you can say, is this going to be offensive in any way? Now, I can tell you that one of the greatest audiences I've ever played for was at the UAHC. That was Union American Hebrew Congress. There was their yearly meeting where the top leaders of this organization come from all over the world. And the minute that piece started, there was a text that they had in their hand. And I love to be in a situation where the people don't ever look at the text because they know it so well. And that's the way that was. And they followed. Then they were able to follow what I did with their text. Most of it was from Isaiah. And everybody there knew it backwards and forwards. Now, with the Catholic Mass, I expect the same situation tomorrow, that people are not going to be looking to see what the words are to this Mass. They've heard them all their lives.
What you're describing now is so different than the process of playing jazz or the process of improvisation, because there you're working against preconceptions, and you don't have to worry, I don't think you should have to worry about how the audience is going to react to what you're doing, in the same way that you have to worry about the boundaries of a liturgical piece. Can you tell us a little bit about how your process of composing and composing any form of music differs from the process of improvisation?
I'd rather quote Stravinsky.
Sure.
In Poetics of Music, he says improvisation is composition, let me start again. Composition is selective improvisation. And that says it better than I've ever heard it said. That covers whole books about it, just in that one sentence, and from a master. So all he's saying is that when you're improvising, especially in public, you don't have the time to be selective. The next fraction of a second, you got to put a finger down. And a whole bunch of skills come into this. This rapid thing that goes from mind to finger. So that if you're thinking about what finger you're going to play a note with, you're dead right there if you don't know your instrument that well.
A good composer isn't necessarily a good improviser, and a good improviser isn't necessarily a good composer, do you think?
In this generation, that's true. In Mozart's time, Mozart was probably a better improviser than he was a composer. And he's one of the greatest composers that ever lived. The same thing is true of Beethoven, probably, and of Bach. In those days, the two were inseparable. And why people owe a great debt to the jazz musicians and the organists of the world is, in a way, we're more traditional. Jazz people are more traditionally classical people than the classical musicians of today that don't improvise, because we really are back to the roots of classical music. It's really hard for me to understand why classical people have forgotten their own tradition so much. And there's gradually a turnaround now with classical musicians improvising again. And they're fantastic improvisers. There are in the world of classical music. But people want to hear that written note and don't realize that it's very much in the classical tradition to do your own cadenzas and to improvise. We could go into this subject for a long time.
I'd like to talk with you about other aspects of your career. You've been in the music business for a long time now, and you've seen a lot of changes happen. What do you think are some of the most dramatic differences in the jazz business today from the early 1950s?
Well, you know, when you travel as much as I do and you work all over the world, as you enter a city, you usually remember the first time you came in, not the 30 other times you've been there. And today, my wife and I walked around Philadelphia a little, and my mind went back to some of the places I worked here, the nightclubs. And I, almost every city I've worked in the nightclubs, lived in places. Paul Desmond and I lived in an apartment in Philly here, where it was so bad you could put your foot through the floor if you didn't step in the right places, and no curtains on the windows, really bad. And then here we are 30 years later, and of course Paul and I played a lot at the Academy of Music, and gradually we came up through the universities and schools in this area from the nightclubs. And that's what I see in the change in my own personal life. It really isn't a change in the music business. It's that if you pay your dues and come up that way, the business end of it will improve. If you're in a situation where your wife and your kids and your friends will starve with you. And that is how I see it. It's going to be the same thing, the bad scene, which isn't necessarily bad to be out there with nothing, because you really get a feeling for what the world is about, how great it can be when you have nothing, And sometimes having everything won't help you at all. And you get a real perspective from coming up the hard way. And I think that anybody playing jazz or any serious dancer, any serious classical musician in this country where we don't support the arts that much has a tough youth, which isn't bad. And you hope that all the suffering and the wonderful things do make them have a happy life and financially have rewards sometime along their life so they can have a, kind of a normal, as close to normal as you can get, where you have your own home. I've just been on the road 6 months and home a week, but I don't have to now. I still love doing it. And my wife's been with me. We've been all over Europe and in the Orient. So I don't know if that answers your question, but the business hasn't actually changed that much. It's still a struggle for the young artists. I'm sorry it's such a struggle for them sometimes, and then sometimes I think that's the only way it can be done in a free country.
When you had first started your quartet in the 1950s, and probably throughout the 1950s, you played a lot on the college circuit, and
right.
It seems like a lot of the people in the colleges were avid jazz listeners. It had a whole lifestyle that surrounded it, or at least looking back, mm-hmm. It seems that way. And that happened with rock music in the late 1960s, but I don't know that that's continued with jazz.
Oh, yes, it has. And I know that my wife wrote to every school on the West Coast, and we kind of pioneered this, my group did. And then we put out albums like Jazz Goes to College, Jazz Goes to Junior College, and we recorded the first kind of live concerts on campus with recordings called Jazz at Oberlin, Jazz at the College of Pacific. And there was a whole audience out there that was not being touched. And we got the reputation then of, people didn't move in and follow us immediately. But years later, everybody was doing what we had pioneered in the college audience. And I think that it's still a very important audience. Like I mentioned, that the first time we played here, we were playing in the nightclubs, a place called the Showboat, the Blue Mirror. And there was another place that Lee Goober owned here in a hotel that we played. Then gradually what we had already done on the West Coast was develop a college audience. We did that out here.
There was a period of time where if you owned one jazz record, chances are you owned one of your records, and chances are it was Time Out.
Mm-hmm.
Do you meet a lot of those people now who had one or just a handful of jazz records and who had a very scratchy recording of yours because they'd listened to it so much? And when they see you now, associate you mm-hmm. with that period of their life?
Oh, yeah, sure. All over the world.
Is that a good feeling or is that a limiting feeling? Since it's also specific to that era when mm-hmm. you think of someone in terms of that one record or that moment in your life two or three decades ago.
Well, to me, that isn't far back because we're just releasing on the Book of the Month Club a 3-album box, and we're going back to 47, and that's early. And so I've just listened to the octet, the trio with Kyle Jader and Ron Crody and some of the early solo piano things in order to get this album together. That, when people have those things, I start feeling that it's ancient. Time Out, to me, isn't that far back. That's only back to 1960.
Tell us how you organized your quartet in the early 1950s.
Well, in 1946, that was after World War II, I went to school on the GI Bill in Oakland, California, at Mills College, which was predominantly a girls' school. There were 750 girls and 3 GIs. And we went there to study with Darius Milhaud, the great French composer. And he asked that the second semester, I got some of my friends to come and study. And he asked, how many jazz musicians are there in the class? And they raised their hands, and he said, well, write all our counterpoint assignments, fugue, and compositions for this group of jazz musicians. Well, there were five of us there, and we added three more, which became the octet that we're just going to release some of those old recordings. And it just turned out that the guys that wanted to study with Darius Milhaud were kind of the avant-garde of the San Francisco area. And the people listening today would know the unknown alto saxophonist, name was Paul Desmond. The unknown drummer was Cal Jader. And the other five guys were as good as myself or Cal or Paul, maybe better. And they haven't become internationally known. Some are only known to musicians. But there were eight very strong young players in that group. And Bill Smith, who occasionally plays with the Still, is to me one of the greatest clarinetists and avant-garde musicians. Maybe I would say he's the father of avant-garde jazz, because he used, he's the first guy to electrify the clarinet. He used tape, the first guy to use synthesizer. Goes on and on. People don't know him. Clarinetists know him. And that's the way that group is. If you mention the other guys, a trumpet player will know Dick Collins. Dick was with Woody Herman, and the tenor saxophonist was with Stan Kenton. It goes on and on. It was just a loaded group, and we were completely unknown. We couldn't work, so I took the rhythm section from that group and made the Dave Brubeck Trio. And we were immediately discovered across the country. And I quit composing because I had been writing a lot for the octet, and it was just too much for the record companies. It wasn't too much for the people. Whenever we got the chance to play, everybody liked us, but we were kept from playing, kept from being hired. In every town, there's a kind of a hierarchy that won't allow the young people a chance. And fortunately, there was a musicians' union fund that when a big show opened in, like, say, Woody Herman came to San Francisco, there had to be a certain number of guys in the pit to play. And in 3 years, we got, two jobs like that, where the musicians' union guys would give us a chance. They almost had to give us a chance, too. I won't say it was all their idea, but we were in the union. We weren't working. I was the only pianist that wasn't playing on New Year's Eve one year in San Francisco. That's how tough it was. That's how much people didn't like the way I played. Other musicians that weren't into what I was doing. So it was very rough for us.
How did the trio become the quartet?
Well, I was in an accident where I hurt myself in Honolulu. In a swimming accident. And from the hospital, I wrote to Paul, who had been in the octet, and said, when I get back, we'll hire such and such guys, and we'll form a quartet. Because I always wanted the octet back. I was going to add each guy back as I became well enough known and established. I was going to have that octet back. But the people didn't even like Paul. When I added him into the trio situation, the first owner asked me to pay Paul. He would pay him 2 weeks if he just would go home and not play. And I said, no way. This is my new group. This is going to be one of the great stars. And I argued with him. He said, well, I like your recordings with the trio, but I don't like, you're messing up your whole style. People are coming here to hear you, and here you've got an alto saxophonist. So whenever I tried to add in the horn players into the rhythm section, I got a lot of static. And Sunday afternoons at the Blackhawk in San Francisco, I used to add the whole five horns, and we made it like a concert. And we had a wire cage in the nightclub so families could come in. There was a very strict law that in no way could they enter the nightclub. So there was like a cyclone fence that was put up. And after they had gone to church, sometimes they'd come to the club, whole families, and we'd put on a concert with the octet. And am I answering your question? Oh, how did the quartet formed after the trio broke up? Then I formed the quartet with Paul, which was so successful. Every time I added another horn to it, people didn't like it, and it really worked. So I had to forget about the octet.
Maybe you can explain a couple of things. Maybe you can explain why you think people reacted to you and Paul so negatively at first, and then within no time you became incredibly popular around the country.
Well, again, let me say it was the nightclub owner.
And not the people, not the patrons.
Not the people. But he had hired me as a trio and on the strength of my recordings. And in those days, people liked what they called a piano trio, which you'd heard all across this country in bars. And when you think of who was popular at that time, Shearing's group didn't have a horn. Garner didn't have a horn. Oscar Peterson didn't have a horn. My competition didn't have a horn. Now, that isn't to say that Jerry Mulligan wasn't doing something. He was doing something without a piano with his quartet. There was a certain style which was really making it, and there usually wasn't a horn with that style. And this club owner was hiring all these people, and none of them had a saxophone or a trumpet, and I shouldn't have one.
In 1954, you were on the cover of Time magazine one week. How did your other friends who are jazz musicians react to that? Because it's a very unusual thing for a jazz musician to be on the cover of Time.
Well, the first phone call I got was from Duke Ellington, awakening me in the morning saying, "Dave, come down in the lobby and see what you're on the cover of Time magazine." Well, I knew I was going to be on. And my biggest regret was that I was going to be on and Duke hadn't been on yet because he was my idol. And yet he called me and told me I was on. We were on tour at the time together. I would say that the musicians I really cared about were happy for me. And that's about all I can say. I never heard anybody come up and put me down for having been on the cover.
I know that many black musicians resent it when white musicians receive fame and a lot of money for their playing, since jazz is a music that has its roots in black culture, and it's been very difficult for many jazz musicians and many black jazz musicians to get any notoriety or a livable amount of money mm-hmm. from their music. Did you feel that any resentment at your success was aimed at you at any point?
Well, not from my friends. And no one else ever came up and ever said anything. Because who were my friends? Louis Armstrong. Louis, the most loving type of person that you'll ever know in your life when you know someone like Louis. Garner also was a loving guy. They aren't going to say anything because we're all out there together. It could have been, well, they were all successful too. And when I was playing on the road with Parker, he was making 15 times as much a night as I was. And I think there's a lot of myths about somebody like Parker never being paid, because I know the facts. Mm-hmm. And I would just say that there's a lot of people that deserve to have a lot more. And I'm just sorry if they don't have it. And it has nothing to do with color.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many, there's Indian musicians and American Indian. People forget that. Recently, I was with four guys that were all part Indian and all great jazz players. it's just not fair to anybody, regardless of color. If you don't have a job and you're a good musician, it's very, very tough.
You and Paul Desmond had probably one of the longest collaborations in jazz, and a very successful collaboration. How did your personalities work together? They must have worked well if you were together for as long as you were.
Yeah, they had to. I'd known Paul since, I guess he was about 18 years old. I was in the infantry going overseas in World War II, and I was trying to get into the band where Paul was playing in the Army, so I wouldn't have to be in the infantry, and I could stay in San Francisco. So when I auditioned for the band, they asked me to have a session, and Paul was one of the people I should play with. And he really didn't know what I was doing, because harmonically I was different than any musician he'd ever played with. So the first meeting was one that he'll always remember, maybe not thinking, gee, I love the way this guy played. I shook him up. And there's some funny sentences that he's written about it since, saying that I look like a surly Sioux, and he accused me of having a purple army jacket on, which I don't remember because I would have been busted out of the army. But he did say that we started to play the blues in B flat, and the first chord I hit was a G major chord, but he wasn't right. It was a G major and a B flat, and he wasn't ready for that. I was into polytonality, polyrhythm, when people didn't know the term, so they couldn't know what I was doing. For instance, one of my most successful nights at Carnegie Hall, where I really thought that the quartet had done what I wanted to do in public, proven what my music was all about. I had Joe Morello in one time signature, Gene Wright in another, I was in another, and Paul was floating in between all of those. And we all had our feet going in the tempo we were playing in. The critic, who was quite well known in a good paper, said it was obvious we couldn't swing, we couldn't even keep time together. Our feet were all, so he wasn't ready. Now, if you hear African music, I can always hear part of an African drum battery, some people four, some in a specific, say, in a specific piece. Some are in four, some are in three, some are in two, some are in time signatures we don't understand yet. And so if you're at one of my concerts in the early days where I'm saying jazz doesn't have to sound like a European march for the next 100 years, because that's how it started, is an imitation of European marching bands in New Orleans. It could be one of the ways it started. I'm in pretty good territory when I say this is a very strong influence. Tiger Rag is an exact Belgian march, only syncopated. It follows everything about a Belgian march. And my point was, I wanted to get into the African influence, and I had a recording made in the Belgian Congo in the 40s. I was listening to that. Most of the black musicians weren't listening to it. They didn't know about it. Most of the white musicians didn't know about it. You should never say black or white, as far as I'm concerned. Most musicians weren't listening to this. I was. I could see that jazz had every right, if it were to copy the great tradition of Africa, to not be in 4-4 the rest of its career. And then one time I was defending why we could use 5-4 time after Take 5 was popular. And there was a meeting of the greatest musical jazz players in Lenox, Mass. At this meeting, people were saying it isn't jazz unless it's in 4-4. 2-4-6-8, something you can divide in two and march to. And there was a black musicologist I didn't know that stood up at the meeting and said, Dave is right. Jazz, and he started singing what he called a field holler. and it was in 5/4 time. He said, "You listen to this. This is more authentic than New Orleans, getting your roots back to Africa." And Dave is right by saying that it shouldn't always be in 4/4. Now, I wasn't alone. There was Max Roach. But Max and I were pretty much alone. There weren't many other people thinking this way.
Did you and Desmond and the other members of the quartet have to train your ears and your bodies to resist the time signature, to resist 4/4 and to resist what the other people were playing if they were playing in a different signature?
This is very interesting because Take Five was a big hit and is still a big hit in Africa because they're still dancing to it. And it was a breakthrough over there. It was a breakthrough all over the world. And Blue Rondo was getting, people didn't think they could dance in five. But I've seen whole dance halls dance in five in those early days where we used to play a lot of dances. You had to be at the right dance hall for people to dance in five. But if you were in the right place, they could. And just like kids will sing in my music, we'll sing in 5 and 7 much easier than adults. If you've been in the right environment or no environment. And so the time signature thing was very hard for us. If you'll remember the original Take Five, I played the vamp the whole time, even through the drum solo. And I didn't take a solo. Somebody had to lock that in. This is, again, like an African drum battery. I was being the 5/4 guy, but on piano. And Joe was being free on the drums over that. I don't think I could have done Time Out without Joe Morello. I could have done it with Cal Jader in the 40s, and I was headed that way, and people just wouldn't let me play that way. So I had to stop doing that. But in these old trio things, I can show you where I'm pushing into new time signatures. And even in the 40s, and people just, other record companies, it was just hard to do it. We had to wait 15 years to do what I wanted to do in the 40s.
You know, it's easy to tap your feet when 1-2, 1-2, and you're in 4/4 time. How do you pace your rhythm when you're in 5/4 or 9/8? How do you get your body and your mind moving to that type of rhythm that you're just not used to?
Well, you have to. Today, it's no problem. But when we first started, it was a problem for us to play in 7 and 9, all the odd meters. But realize that in the Greek music, in Turkish music, in all of the African music, in all the Oriental Indian music, it's very hard for some cultures, especially in India, it's very hard for them to play in 4/4. Because we've tried it. Joe Morello and I have had a lot of fun with the Indian musicians, where they could do things that were terribly hard that we couldn't do, but they couldn't play a 4/4, they couldn't play a real waltz kind of thing. So it depends on where you were born and raised and what you heard, far more than what nationality you are, what color your skin is. It's what you've heard. And this is, if I could get one thing across in my life, is what we've all got to come to, is that we're one race. We are the human race. All these divisions only hurt us. And if you really want to go to your roots, go back to the beginning. We're all one.
Dave Brubeck is my guest. If you're just joining us, we're talking about his music. I'd like to get back to your collaboration with Desmond and ask you again what it was about you both that kept you together, what musically or within your personalities worked so well that you were able to play together for a long time and still feel good about it.
Yeah, well, it was over 30 years, and I think we both liked the same kind of music. Our favorite composers range from Bach to Stravinsky and Bartok. And also we liked a lot of the same jazz records. And after my initial meeting with him, when he got used to the idea of playing in two keys at once and two time signatures at once, he became, in many ways, he took my ideas into the sax way of thinking and developed them where I wouldn't have gone in a lot of ways. And because he had such a great mind, pieces like 11-4 that Paul wrote. In those days, people weren't playing in 11. But he was mainly, Paul was a lyricist. And rather than me remain a lyricist, I would try to balance what Paul was doing, and I would become more of a brittle kind of player. So we'd have a balance in the group. I always believe in every group I've ever had, if it's a quartet, you got to have four individuals. Because we're on stage usually 2.5 hours. And if Paul had done what he wanted to do most every night and dominated what was going to happen, we'd have lost part of that audience. But the people that loved what Paul did would get that during the night, that's for sure. The people that loved what Joe Morello did, which was and is one of the great drummers that's ever lived, and in many ways the best. And then Gene Wright was what we called, he locked the quartet in. Everything worked from Gene up. Without Gene having the exact personality that he had, or another player like Gene, the quartet wouldn't have been able to work. The basic beat came from Gene and the rest of us, and he was locked in. Like he said, man, I play the blues. And he wanted to have that blues feeling, no matter if we were in 5, some way he'd get a blues feeling to it, or in 9. And this is, people didn't know why our group worked, because with a diverse audience worldwide, but we had so much going on with 4 guys, so many different approaches, and we weren't the kind of group that you said, this is what they sound like, because the next tune we didn't sound like what we sounded like the tune before, or the next night, or the next week. Some night, Paul would dominate a concert. Some night, Joe might. Some night I did, and some night it would be Gene. And if it's just like a basketball team, if a guy is really hot and communicating and inspired, you let that guy work that night. When he cools off, somebody else take it.
You and Desmond played together a long time. Did things ever get predictable? Did you ever know when he was going to play?
That's what's funny. Right up to his death, I would say that I couldn't tell you exactly what Paul was going to do any more than when I first knew him. And he didn't know what I was going to do. And there is the fascination between why we could stay together so long, is we didn't know what each other would do, but we would probably like it. Not all the time, but most of the time.
You've been playing with your sons for the past few years, on and off for the past few years. One of your sons is featured on your new record and is now in the new Dave Brubeck Quartet. You've played with 2 of your other sons as well, or perhaps mm-hmm. more than that. When your sons were young, did you have it in your head that they were going to grow up to be musicians?
Oh, I thought they might play music, but I was hoping that they would choose professions where they wouldn't have the rough life of traveling all the time. And they are really happiest when they're out in the road now. And they've tried other things, some of them. But they were raised in the back of a car and traveling. And one of my sons explained to me that to this day, he really relaxes when he sees me up there driving. They're heading to a new town, and it's like he was a little kid again. You know, they're in the back, maybe sleeping. And that's the way we had to go. Sometimes I'd drive across the country without staying in a motel. I'd have to drive. kids sleep in the back, my wife taking care of the kids. And I guess they'll never get that out of there. That was their life, and they're still doing it, and they're happy doing it. And I had hoped that they would play music but have a better home life.
In many families, there's quite a gap between the two generations as far as what they like musically.
Mm-hmm.
Did that ever happen with you, that your sons thought that your music was old-fashioned and they wanted a completely different kind of music?
Well, they've been kind to me, and they've played my music and seemed to like it. And when I hear their new recordings, I don't think that they've left me completely in the dust, and I feel like they're an extension of a direction I was pointing for them. And if I could understand just some of the complicated things they do, if they explain them a little more to me, I think I could catch on. And sometimes they learn from me how to be more basic and how to use something better that they've wandered into. But I admire them, and I love playing. When my three sons were in the group, I was really kind of too proud, you know, and I was too happy, maybe, you know. That's a great thrill, to walk out on stage with three of your kids that are there because they're great musicians, not because they're your sons. And this is what hurt them, is sometimes they get the vibe from people that they were there because they were my sons. This isn't true. They wouldn't have just recorded all three of them with Larry Coryell and play with the other people that they do. But you can't go out on stage and make an announcement. And so this made it sad in a way, knowing that they felt that people didn't yet realize that they were capable on their own. So now they're out proving themselves to themselves. They don't have to prove anything to me.
Do you think that their music affected your feelings about electronic instruments and jazz?
Oh, yeah. They opened me up to a lot of things. And I don't think I would have used synthesizers. But you got to realize, a little while ago I said that Bill Smith was the first musician to ever use a synthesizer. And he would have been 20 years before my kids. And he was... I did a lot of things that Bill suggested when he was in my group. So, you know, they're going to have a hard time getting past where we were, and yet they know they got to do it. And I'm sorry that it's a thing in their mind, you know, because that isn't the way. It should just be a natural thing. Everybody leave them alone, you know.
I think all children go through that period where they have to feel that they're their own selves, and what you have to do to break away from your parents, and once that happens, you reestablish relationships real strong again.
Now, the son that stayed with me, he had his own rock groups, and they've recorded a lot and everything, so he's been through it. He's had his own group, and he has just written a Broadway show, and so he's doing things on his own. And they know they're free to come in and out of the group as easily as not to hurt anybody else.
Did you have to learn how to not be a father on the bandstand?
Oh, boy. I had to learn not to be a father off the bandstand. We were traveling all day. You know, this went on 7 years in some form or another, where there'd be two or three of my sons playing with me every night. And the leader... Like, they would hang out with Paul and Jerry Mulligan and Jack Six and Alan Dawson, because the leader is the guy you don't hang out with. He's got to be, and nobody says this. You just see it happening, just like the old days, just like with Duke, I'm not going to name other guys that are alive, but there is a certain role that the leader has to play, even if he doesn't want to. Even if it's your own kids, you can't hang out so much. And also, you're so busy, and I'm always writing. And so there is a role, and there's a hands-off policy in almost any successful band. As long as a guy shows up and can play, you don't say much. That's all you hope for as a leader. And whether they're your sons or not, as long as they can play the job, that's what. So it was a fine line. When it was time to be a father on the road, I was always glad my wife was along. You know, when it was be something where, it would be funny to me. But say we're playing with a symphony orchestra and the kids don't want to wear a tux.
Right.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I can tell you what happened. The kids did wear tuxes and the orchestra conductor said, put them back in the overalls. It looks better.
Oh, God. Dave Brubeck, we are out of time. I have to thank you for being here. It was so much fun to meet you and to speak with you. Thanks so much for coming to Fresh Air. My only regret is we didn't get to hear any of your music during the past 45 minutes, but I'll play some records tomorrow. Dave Brubeck's in Philadelphia for the premiere of a mass that he wrote. And the mass is called To Hope, a Mass for a New Decade. The premiere will be at the Cathedral Basilica on 18th and the Parkway at 8 o'clock tomorrow. For more information about this performance, you can call 587-3696. The Dave Brubeck Quartet is now on Concord Records, and they'll have a new record in August. We have a couple seconds.
I want to say that the rehearsal last night, the choir was great, and I'm looking forward to Wednesday.
Okay. We're out of time. I want to thank you for being here. That's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Listener-supported public radio.